This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Yeehaw.
Hi, Benji. Don't worry, Sequitur is not becoming a weekly show. On a practical level, we're sort of making up for lost time from the 7 weeks surrounding the International Day of Peace when I was traveling and then recovering from same. All the same, I would remind you that this is our 21st show in 2017, which will work out to 2 a month on the average.
Once you get it that you won't abide, there's still something else to decide. Unfortunately, the choices are 3, predation, starvation, or suicide. Yeehaw!
Have you ever noticed that people are more than ready to talk about starvation, and even predation in the form of military aggression? But when it comes to suicide, there's a strong cultural taboo to overcome. Guy McPherson and I sure did violate that one last time on Sequitur Terminal Diagnosis.
Extinction we're causing worldwide might be thought of as suicide, but if ending the pain is seen as humane, euthanasia is what's being applied. Hee-haw!
Good point, Benji. Let's make like a textbook and start with definitions of key terms. Euthanasia literally means good death, but the term was co-opted by pet owners to describe what they were doing when they brought their fur babies to the vet for lethal injection and incineration. Clearly, the person is making a rational decision on behalf of another being. Suicide, on the other hand, means self-killing, which is the foundation of my claim in Sequitur Terminal Diagnosis that physician-assisted suicide is an oxymoron. If the doctor helps, then the act could be called euthanasia in its strictest sense of good death. But that opened up a whole legal can of worms about the possibility of insurance profiteering by corporations or fraud by consumers, convenience killing of the injured or elderly and disabled, or even ethnic cleansing or genocide if people were empowered to make such a choice on behalf of another individual or class. So the preferred terminology these days is physician-assisted death, or PAD, for humans, which is legally held as a form of suicide, which we learned last time is never illegal as long as no one helps, as contrasted with euthanasia in the case of non-human animals. Guy and I only scratched the surface on the topic of conscious death, both the possibility of our own and our reactions to that of people we admired before and after they made that choice. In fact, I will do a delayed reading of the names for those 2 people, as well as that of a 3rd, unmistakably a victim of the deep state, during the instrumental portion of the musical interlude in today's featured interview. As described on our Facebook page, the interview is with the makers of Tomorrow Never Knows, a documentary movie about the death of Shar Jones, a transgendered person who chose to voluntarily stop eating and drinking rather than suffer the drawn-out dying from early-onset Alzheimer's dementia.
I'm sitting here with Darcy Myers and Adam Sekuler, and they are involved with a project that I think will be very interesting to listeners. So I'm going to start with Darcy, since I met Darcy first. I'm actually in another group with Nancy True, the person who recommended you to me. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you're doing here today?
Yeah, well, I know Nancy. We've worked in hospice and end-of-life care, both of us, for many years, and our paths have crossed over the years. And I was working as a Buddhist chaplain, and also I'm a psychotherapist as well, mind-body psychotherapist, and started to move more into private practice, which is what I do now.
Let me slow you down for just a minute. I know what a Buddhist is, and I know what a chaplain is, but what's a body psychotherapist?
Body-mind psychotherapist, Utilizing not just a therapy that works with the mind, but also with the body. Having an awareness of the whole mind-body system in healing and not just what's happening mentally. Oh. So there's a whole field of psychotherapy, of somatic psychotherapy, and that's what I practice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Your documentary, first of all, is called Tomorrow Never Knows.
I'll just give the background and turn it over to Adam. He'll have a lot to say about that too. So I was actually introduced to Cynthia Vitale and Shar Jones through Nancy True, and they were looking for a Buddhist chaplain to help them navigate, you know, Shar's end-of-life journey. He was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease and knew that he did not want to live through the whole course of that illness, knowing what that looks like at the end stage with Alzheimer's. He also was a Buddhist practitioner and was really looking for somebody who could support him in the way that he wanted to be supported, and that's how we got connected. And after many months of working with the two of them, with Cynthia and Shar, and supporting them and helping them to really formulate what their wishes are and help Shar get clear about what he wanted, the more I got to know him, the more I realized that there was a story here, that his life story was so interesting that I found myself just eager to talk about it. And I have another friend who is the founder of Natural Transitions in Boulder, Colorado. Her name is Karen Van Buren. And Karen had done some films in the past around end-of-life issues and concerns. And I had consulted with her and said, you know, I really feel like there's a story here and I don't know how to make a film and it's not my expertise, but I think there's something here. And she put me in touch with a cinematographer who I met with briefly, who wasn't the right person for the project, but put me in touch with Adam. And when Adam showed up on the scene, he and Shar and Cynthia connected immediately and filming began pretty quickly. And maybe I'll turn that over to you, Adam, because I think you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so as Darcy said, you know, I got pulled into the project through a mutual friend who, for any number of reasons, couldn't really end up working on the project, but Darcy introduced me to Shar and Cynthia. I started coming over to their home and spending some time with them, and as Darcy said, you know, like, Shar and I really ended up having a bond pretty quickly, and the bond, in some ways, was built off of music. The first day that I arrived at his house with a camera, one of the first things I stumbled across in their home was this notebook that had a list of songs, and on the top of it, it said, "Music to Die To." And I was like, oh my God. So I started talking to Shar about, you know, what is this list? What are you doing with this list? And he told me that this was the playlist he wanted to have being played as his death was occurring. And I asked him what was the final song on the list. And he told me it was Tomorrow Never Knows. And from that moment forward, it was really clear that that would be the name of the film. You know, some of that part of his story isn't really in the movie. So like the idea of the playlist isn't in the film. But the ways in which the music ends up getting incorporated into the film is very much about trying to help Shar fulfill these wishes around what music would be playing in the representation of his death as much as in his death itself.
Okay, so let me say for our younger listeners that Tomorrow Never Knows is one of those songs that has a title that never shows up in the lyrics. It comes from the album Revolver by the Beatles. What's the refrain that people might recognize more readily from that song?
I don't know if there's really a refrain, but I might try to hum or sing a little bit of the song. It's turn off your mind, relax, and float down.
Yeah. I think people will know it by that. That's a really fantastic lyric.
I should say that for Shar, there's this interesting connection for that song to the process of dying. And he talked to me a lot about how in writing of that song, John Lennon was thinking a lot about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that was obviously, you know, that was one of the guides, I guess, that he was turning to in trying to figure out how he would end his life, looking for the teachings from that book and other books.
Would it be appropriate for me to ask you to send me that song list?
You know, Darcy and I should probably talk about at what point that might be appropriate in terms of just making sure that the people who've contributed to our film get the benefit that they thought they were getting before other folks.
Well, that's a good point too. So the trailer doesn't use Tomorrow Never Comes. The trailer uses this Dusty Springfield song.
Well, what you saw was the pitch video, which is different from the trailer, actually.
Oh, okay.
So the pitch video uses the Dusty Springfield song. And the last song in the film that you see Shar singing while he's alive is that song. So I brought that into the pitch video for that reason.
So let's pause for a moment and listen to Dusty Springfield's rendition of Carole King's song, Going Back. Lyrics can be found at the Panina webpage for this show. Williams, 11 August 2014, age 63, hanging. Michael Craig Rupert, 13 April 2014, age 63, gunshot to the head. Aaron Hillel Swartz, 11 January 2013, age 26, hanging.
So catch me if you can. I'm going back.
Thank you for that musical moment to pay tribute to some important cultural icons who ended their lives by suicide.
And is there then a formal trailer separate from the pitch video?
There is a formal trailer. I mean, it's been kind of in flux periodically. And it does have Char singing Tomorrow Never Knows.
Mm-hmm. And you'll find that actually at the Seed and Spark website under the media tab. A lot of people kind of miss it because the first video that you see when you go to Seed and Spark Tomorrow Never Knows is the pitch video. And under the media tab, you can watch the trailer.
Okay, very good. I certainly did miss it, although I did find the pitch video.
Yeah. Great, great.
So you keep saying, speaking to Char and the last thing before he dies, maybe this is spilling your beans or stealing your thunder or something, but so Char is still alive or?
Char passed September 1st of last year.
Yes. You know, one of the things that became very clear to me when I first started working with Cynthia and Char, I think it was the first or second visit I had with him, he said, I understand that this disease means I'm going to lose my mind and I want to die consciously. And he was a Buddhist practitioner. He had a meditation practice. This meditation practice actually was incredibly helpful for him throughout his life. He had a very interesting life, a brilliant mathematician, but also experienced a lot of discrimination in his life. And meditation was very helpful for him in navigating his world. And he wanted to be able to have that experience while he was dying. So he made the choice to voluntarily stop eating and drinking so that he could have more influence over the way that he died, that he could die the way that he wanted. And he had full support of his wife, Cynthia, to do that. In fact, Cynthia is featured very prominently in the film because her role in being able to first find me and to find all these resources, the support that he needed to be able to die the way that he wanted to die. And we got to fulfill all of those wishes for him, including documenting it. And for him, documenting it was really important because he was a true activist and he wanted his life and his death to be of benefit to other people.
Right, right. So, okay, mundane details. He died on 1st of September, 2016.
That's right.
As part of my personal altar, I have a graveyard. And I would very much like to put up a headstone for Char if you would give me his date of birth and his actual full name. The full name that he would like to be remembered by. I shouldn't say actual. It's not like that.
It's Char Jones, S-H-A-R, and then Jones. And Adam, do you remember his birth date?
April 11th, 1952.
You know, there is one other thing I'd just like to say about this voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for your listeners to know that this is always an option. It's a legal option in the United States when one, you know, has an illness. And maybe I know there are right to die laws in some states where there's assisted, supported dying, but not in every state. And even in the states where there is that law, there are often requirements around that that exclude certain people, like people with dementia are often excluded because there's the idea that they can't make a rational, informed choice if they have dementia or Alzheimer's. So if one wants to have some sort of say over their end-of-life process, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking is one of those legal options. And there's a lot of support to do that.
Yes.
This non-medical end-of-life option has become so widespread that it is known by its acronym, VSED, or Voluntarily Stop Eating and Drinking. According to the March-April 1995 American Journal of Hospice and Palliative Care, quote, the refusal of food and fluids does not contribute to suffering among the terminally ill, unquote, within the context of adequate palliative care, and might even contribute to a comfortable passage from life. Quote, at least for some persons, starvation does correlate with reported euphoria, end quote. In light of this finding, one must question the protocol that prescribes the routine insertion of an IV catheter as a first response to trauma. I wouldn't say that if I were a member of an endangered species, but in this time of population overshoot and resource depletion, I find myself unwilling to endorse the level of entitlement that says human lives must be saved at all cost, especially when human lives really means the lives of insured, privileged citizens of industrialized nations. I don't leave home without my DNR paperwork and other end-of-life documents, so that if I'm hit by a bus and rendered unconscious, I will not be fed, hydrated, or dosed with antibiotics. Besides my felt sense and rational opinion that my species is not long for this world anyway, there are certain things I would not want to live to remember. In other words, I've already exceeded my lifetime quota of trauma and recovery from trauma.
I just wanted to mention, as we're talking about this choice, this VSED choice, mm-hmm. there's an organization, a national organization called Compassion and Choices.
I'm a member.
Great. This is an organization that does a lot of education and advocacy in support of people who want to make that choice.
That's interesting because my literature from them really emphasizes the physician-assisted option and not the self-directed option.
I think some of that, at least from talking to the folks who were involved in this particular case, it seemed as though some of that had to do with the advocacy work that they're doing around changing the legal status of physician-assisted suicide nationally. So they're, you know, working on a campaign to do that state by state. So I'm sure that that literature is foregrounded in their website.
And in their newsletter. That's I'm referring more to their newsletter. I do have their publications that include the helium and plastic bag how-to, which seems very complicated to me, but another one of those self-directed choices that a person can make without physician's assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Although I understand the industry is on to that now, and they're no longer providing 100% helium for party balloons. Used to be you could go to the party store and get a helium tank without any trouble, but all of a sudden it's problematic.
Mm.
And there is the issue of the reflexive panic that sets in with suffocation that is not the case with voluntarily stop eating and drinking.
Right.
Before we continue with Char's story, I want to review a few of the other organizations from coast to coast and around the world that are engaged with the increasingly vocal Right to Die movement. The World Federation of Right to Die Societies was founded in 1980 and consists of 45 organizations from 25 countries. The Federation provides an international link for organizations working to secure or protect the rights of individuals to self-determination at the end of their lives with regular meetings and other resources. World Right to Die Day was founded at the 2008 conference in France and is also celebrated in Italy, New Zealand, Venezuela, and other countries, often in connection with Dia de los Muertos. Exit International, quote, sets itself apart from other aid and dying organizations in that we take a civil rights, read non-medical, approach to a person's right to determine the time and manner of their passing. Dying is not always a medical process. As such, the dying process does not always need to involve the medical profession. This decision is best left to the individual concerned. Exit's aim is to ensure the individual is fully supported by family and friends and has access to the best available information. End quote. The TEDx Darwin Australia address by Exit International's founder Philip Nitschke is worth the 20-minute listen. Exit has a free newsletter. You can sign up at their website. They also publish the Peaceful Pill Handbook. The electronic version is a monthly update for a cost of $85 for a 2-year subscription. The advantage of the ebook is that it has all the latest advances, including information about reliable sources of the necessary drugs. The most popular drug is sodium pentobarbital, or Nembutal. Traditionally used at lower doses as a sleep aid. It is now heavily regulated but can be obtained by mail order. Dr. Nitschke says it has a shelf life of 20 years and recommends a dose of 15 grams. It seems to me that the 2-year subscription format would be adequate assurance against impulsive decision-making. The Final Exit Network takes its name and its inspiration from the Hemlock Society, the group that grew up around Derek Humphrey's book Final Exit, now in its third edition. In addition to terminally ill residents of states in which physician aid in dying has been legislatively sanctioned and regulated, this group offers guidance for those who fall outside of normally accepted medical parameters or live in other states. The Hemlock Society was founded to provide support for people interested in legal, medical, moral, and social issues around conscious death. 15 years ago, the Hemlock Society was absorbed by Compassion and Choices, the group Darcy mentioned that operates mostly in the legislative arena. Included in the literature I got from Compassion and Choices are the alarming statistics about the severe under-referral of the terminally ill to hospice care, a necessary prerequisite in the medical model of assisted suicide. Alarming because of the clear evidence of the rule of money. It's not that hospice care is being withheld. It's more that if the patient has the audacity to live for more than 6 months, their insurance plan will no longer support their care. Thanks to the Compassion and Choices newsletter for an up-to-date list of states in the U.S. with physician aid in dying. Oregon as of 1994, Washington as of 2008, Vermont as of 2013, California as of 2015, Washington, D.C. as of 2016, and Colorado as of 2016. Montana did not pass a law, but in 2009, their Supreme Court ruled that a physician was not liable to prosecution for prescribing a lethal dose to a rational adult with a short enough prognosis. And that brings me to the key objection to the medical model to which Darcy alluded moments ago. There are those with illnesses that are fatal more than 6 months after quality of life has deteriorated beyond what can be called dignified. Whether from physical trauma or Alzheimer's, brain-damaged people can be kept alive long past the time at which they would choose if they were in a position to make a choice. In a bizarre catch-22 situation, the medical model requires that the person be of sound mind when the decision is made, often demanding a second opinion from a psychiatrist, many of whom will diagnose a mental illness based on suicidality, regardless of motivations. So the person desiring a conscious death is reduced to a sort of doctor shopping lobbyist. In my conversation with Darcy's colleague Nancy True, I learned that while the people passed the law, doctors are often more interested in prolonging life than in facilitating death, despite the preferences of the patient. And who would compel a doctor into collusion with a practice that violates his or her personal ethics? And that brings me to the Swiss organization Dignitas, which is unique in at least two important respects. One is that the person need not be a citizen or even a permanent resident of Switzerland if they can afford the extensive stay that is necessary for the consultations and legal proceedings. And the other is that there is no requirement for a 6-month prognosis. According to a paper in the Journal of Medical Ethics from November 2008, 21% of Dignitas-assisted deaths did not have terminal or progressive illnesses, intractable chronic pain, or even unmanageable mental illnesses, but rather a quote-unquote weariness of life.
Predation, starvation, or suicide? The choices are three, very few, so it's probably worth thinking through what you plan to do when the end reaches you, and then wait your turn in the queue. Our living depends on predation. Without it, we end in starvation. If those don't look good, the other choice would be to end it with self-termination. Hee-haw!
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at pianina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A. INA, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
I'll say something else as we're talking about this voluntarily stop eating and drinking. At least in Colorado, and the way it worked for Shar is that once he stopped eating and drinking for, was it 24 hours or 48 hours, Adam, before hospice came in?
Hospice took 48 hours.
48, yeah. So they needed to know that he had stopped eating and drinking for 48 hours for them then to admit him to hospice. And we had hospice care for him in the home.
Uh-huh.
It's also helpful to note that, you know, he had to, I don't know if he had to, but he did write out advance directives about this process, that he wanted to have this process as part of his end of life. And so putting that in writing was an important part of allowing all of the other legal aspects to be initiated.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the film. You get a good view into his process in putting that together.
Yeah, that's a good thing for people to be able to see happening. I'm wondering, maybe it's in the film, but I'd still like to hear in advance, how you maintain comfort care.
The good news is that we had hospice, and we actually did have some medicine on board for comfort care, including morphine and something for anxiety. And so he was like getting small doses of that regularly just to kind of take the edge off the experience of discomfort, but so that he could still be alert and aware. And that was his choice to do that. And at one point, he definitely had really dry eyes, but also because of another condition. So he was getting a lot of moisturizing eye drops. And there is some moisturizing mouth gel that's also really helpful. And that was, he was using that on occasion, and also sucking on ice cubes a little bit. Not a lot, because he didn't want to extend the dying process, right?
Yeah.
But enough to alleviate discomfort. And the interesting thing, you know, Shar was very with it through the entire end-of-life journey. The last couple of days when he went to bed and started the active dying process, you know, it only took a couple of days. But before that, he was very active. He was hiking, he was talking and really engaged and very present in his life in the way that he wanted to be.
After stopping eating and drinking, he was hiking?
10 days into not eating and drinking, we went on a hike. 11 days in, we actually went on a hike again, but he really couldn't do the day 11. And shortly after that point is when he ended up going into the final stages.
And how long was it between the time that he got off of nutrition and hydration and the time that he actually expired? How long was that window?
15 days.
15 days. Wow. And still hiking on day 10. That's just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shar.
Yeah, that was Shar. And, you know, one of the pleasures of his life was hiking. Like, he loved to be in nature. He loved to be outdoors. And that was one of those things. Like, if he couldn't do that and he couldn't listen to music, you know, there are a few really key important things in his life. And if he couldn't do those things, he wouldn't be able to have the quality of life he wanted. So hiking was really important all through the end of his life.
And he really stayed present and conscious at the end.
He did, until he went to bed and started the active dying process. And he pretty much went to bed, and it started happening very quickly at that point.
Yeah, I think it was within 36 hours of him going to bed.
And up until that point, he would sleep at night, get up at regular time in the morning, stay awake most of the day. He might nap on and off, but he was awake and interacting and very alert and, you know, still talking about how he wants his death to be and very engaged in that way. He was very courageous.
Yeah.
And generous. I have to bring the concept of generosity in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to share this very, very intimate story with the public, with strangers, with people who may receive it with hostility, never mind lack of openness.
So far, that hasn't been our experience, but we'll see.
We've had incredible support.
I'm really relieved to hear that. With a medical situation, I can imagine that being true. But the reason I'm so interested in hearing the details of this story is because there are people that I know who don't have medical reasons, who would opt for a conscious death, conscious, premeditated, planned death, as reaction to other things besides illness or injury. And I'm thinking here of my Doomer friends who are quite convinced that we are guilty of population overshoot and it's about time to get out of the way so that Mother Nature can come in and repair the damage that we've caused. I'd like to hear what comes up in you when I say that.
Well, certainly, I guess on a philosophical level, I could relate to some of those ideas, like, you know, really feeling my own pain and suffering at what's happening to people, to the earth. There's a lot happening politically that I don't agree with. And there's a lot of suffering. And I certainly see that with the clients that I work with, how difficult it is to be alive today under these circumstances. You know, from a Buddhist perspective, there's this idea of karma, that we all come here with result of past actions, that we are here actually to heal or to purify, and that when we interrupt that karma, we don't get an opportunity on an individual level for liberation. And it's interesting because some of my Buddhist friends who have seen the film had this question, you know, in their mind about Char, as a Buddhist practitioner, making a decision to have a conscious death rather than allowing the disease to run its course. There was this question about, well, what does that mean for karma and individual liberation? And I'm not sure that there's an answer to that question, but I think it's an interesting one. And I think this is why it's such an individual choice. And I don't have any blanket idea or statement about the way things should be in terms of people making decisions at the end of life about how they end their life or at the end of life due to illness or disease. I absolutely support individual choice. And I think that's critical. And my sense of Char and Cynthia was that they had a very clear idea of what was important to them, particularly Char. And because of that, I felt like even on a spiritual level, that that was beneficial because he got to do what was important to him that was in alignment with his values. So I think it's really that question of what are your values and what is most important to you.
I'll just say I couldn't have said any of that better than Darcy just did. So,
Thank you for that. So you're advocating for full choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the interference that's being offered by the legal and legislative arm of the culture has to do with what can possibly go wrong with people with nefarious intent who want to see somebody die because what? They have insurance policies or they're pissed off at them or any number of different reasons for wanting a person dead. And I think there's this sense that if we restrict it to medical and legal supervision, that we will somehow sidestep the shadow side of human nature. You have any comments about that, Darcy?
Wow. I mean, I think we're living in the shadow side of human nature right now. There's no sidestepping here, and there is no sidestepping, unfortunately. Like, this is the reality of being human, you know? And we're just in a time where that shadow side is really up for examination, and my hope is it's up for examination so we can heal it. How it has to do with those choices at end of life, certainly I think it has to go back to the individual values and choice, which also is connected to community values and choice, because we all need support of our community to make those choices if we're going to make those choices. Having supportive community also ensures that if people do have intentions that aren't so helpful, that that will be seen and recognized. And we can't control everything that happens.
Right. I'm right there beside you. I think that, you know, when a person is making these momentous decisions, you know, this is not a choice. This person didn't go and open their closet. Now, which blouse shall I wear today with which skirt? It's not a matter of personal choice as much as it is personal inclination. And then checking that inclination with all of those important others in your life, you know, whether that's family or tribe or community or your doctor. I mean, I don't want to exclude the medical practitioners. On the other hand, I don't want to restrict it.
I'll say this one thing, which is when we, and this is in the film as well, we went to one of the doctors and he knew what Char's wishes were. And, you know, essentially what he expressed was exactly what you just expressed. That the important thing is for the individual to be able to communicate those desires with all of the people around them and make sure that those desires are clear.
Make sure all the options are on the table, in other words.
I don't even know if it's about options. It was about Char's intent, making sure that the people around him understood what his intent was. The doctor made no attempt to dissuade Char from his decision. Maybe that's a unique situation, and I'm sure in certain other parts of the country, like where I'm living now, for instance, I imagine that you might not encounter a doctor like that as often as you would in Colorado, specifically in that part of Colorado that we...
Or even Oregon. I've been hearing about pushback from the medical profession in states where they have this...
assisted suicide laws, yeah.
They're getting a lot of pushback from the doctors themselves who absolutely do not want to cooperate with people like Char. Never mind people like Doomers who just want to get out of the way so their children can thrive.
Yeah. As I understand it from the Compassion and Choices people who were involved with us, this decision around not eating and drinking is one that actually is legal across the board and anybody can make those kinds of choices.
That's right.
No matter where they are in their life or dying process. The court system has supported that. That's your constitutional right based upon a Supreme Court case that went through the legal system. And so there are these ways in which the law and the medical field are controlling the options you have. In Char and Cynthia's case, there was a point where Cynthia expressed, you know, just how hard that process was. There was many points in this process where Char wished that he had other options available to him. For legal reasons as well, he made the decision that he did so that the people around him could receive what other benefits the society bestows upon the death process. You know, like what are the insurance results of somebody passing and all of those things. There's a lot that he and Cynthia had to get into order in order for those things even to occur. So, yeah, I mean, we live in a pretty litigious society. And as a result of that, I think also possibly some of the doctors who are putting up resistance are doing so because of other litigious consequences that could occur to them, to their practice, et cetera. It's very complicated as a result.
Follow the money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Malpractice insurance is very expensive already, and they don't want to increase their liability if some disgruntled relative comes crawling out of the woodwork and makes an objection. Thank you for bringing that out. Okay, so I don't want to drain all the juice out of your film. So I would like to spend a few minutes here talking about the timeline. When can I find it at Amazon, or when is it going to be playing in my local theater? And give you a chance to share with our listeners how we can support the project financially.
The process of getting a film out into the world is also its own kind of bureaucratic nightmare. There's problems in the law, there's problems in the systems that allow for films to get seen as widely as they possibly can. We're in the early phases of going through the kind of formal process of getting a film released. So that means that we've submitted the film to festivals, some big festivals that we should be hearing back from in the coming months. Should it get into one of those festivals, kind of the life of the film starts to take off in a very natural way because there is an ecosystem in which a film can survive and there's all these pathways for the film to find its way into your home and your community. Should that not happen, then, you know, the burden is on us to figure out how to get the film seen as widely as we possibly can. I have some experience in that, so we're prepared. Should we need to release the film ourselves, then make sure that it is in the hands of people like yourself or your listeners so that we can share Char's story as widely as possible. There's no easy answer to the first part of your question about when people can see it. There's an easier answer to how they can support the film. And maybe, Darcy, you want to?
We actually did a crowdfunding campaign. And you can go to seedandspark.com and put in the film's name, Tomorrow Never Knows. And you can read about the film. You can watch the trailer and the pitch video, as I talked about, so you can get some really good information about kind of the flavor of the film. And we're no longer taking donations through Seed and Spark because that campaign is over. But you can send donations through PayPal to our email, which is tomorrowneverknowsfilm@gmail.com. And hopefully we'll also have some way through Seed and Spark to send you over there as well.
Say the PayPal address one more time.
So the email that you can send it through PayPal is tomorrowneverknowsfilm@gmail.com. The other website, just to say it again, is seedandspark.com. Just search for Tomorrow Never Knows.
And that's and spelled out or the and symbol?
For the website, it's spelled out. The URL is spelled out.
Seed and Spark, and then they have their own context search where you can enter Tomorrow Never Knows, and it'll come up with your page, yeah?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's some great information on there for people to learn more about the film.
And it doesn't cost anything to become a supporter. So whether or not you want to make a PayPal donation, please click the support link and get notified when they post updates and such.
Thank you so much. And we will be posting some more updates soon because, you know, Adam has been working really hard with folks to edit the film. So sound and color editing to make it a very professional piece. So we will be putting out a few more updates now that that process is finished. And the more followers we get from Seed and Spark, the more benefits, you know, that they will give us in terms of supporting the project.
Yeah, so they offer a lot in the way of assisting distribution of the film, and you have to get 500 followers in order to open up these packages that they have available. So we're currently, like, we're almost at 300 or something like that. So there's a lot more people that we have to cultivate to support the film that way. But we had over 200 people who supported the film financially so far, and the process of getting a film out is really arduous and expensive. So support from anyone is really appreciated.
We also do have a Facebook page. I'll just mention you can go onto Facebook and search Tomorrow Never Knows, and you can like us there too. We'll be putting more information up there as well.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you so much for inviting us to be on the show with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving me an hour or two of your Saturday to show up for Sequitur. And you can rest assured that the interview will be a nice, clean, condensed 30 or 40 minutes.
Great.
I will send you the link as soon as it's available.
And it is my sincere hope that your appearance on Sequitur Exit Strategy will result in lots more supporters for the film, so that you can earn those promotional premiums from Seed and Spark.
Thank you.
It is worth repeating here that it is not against the law to kill yourself. What is against the law is helping someone else to die, no matter the compassionate intention. How ironic, then, that it is also illegal to refuse orders to kill another. In fact, it is ludicrous that we spend taxpayer dollars on so-called suicide prevention in a nation state that spends more on killing than any other on earth. We even celebrate such state-sanctioned killing with a holiday called Veterans Day, while maintaining the strictest silence about the fact that there are an average of 22 suicides among military veterans every day. Say what? Remember when Veterans Day was called Armistice Day? And it was a celebration of hard-won peace, not reflexive war? The involvement of the so-called healthcare industry in the dying process is increasing due to our apparent determination to monetize all aspects of life and pathologize death. It will be more difficult to reclaim sovereignty in dying than it has been in the case of giving birth, since more dying people self-identify as being in need of so-called medical assistance. Nevertheless, the movement for the right to medical assistance in ending a pregnancy may be setting an important precedent about decision-making regarding one's own body, and the medical model might be an important step along the way that will release a great many people from unnecessary suffering. Yet I worry about issues of privilege and entitlement. I remember lessons learned from the Nazis about the resources of space and time required to deal with dead bodies at the scale that will be required during the coming hard times. How might their remains be processed without danger to the still living? There will come a time, there have already been times, when even mass graves will be inadequate based on sheer numbers and the need for acreage on which to grow crops. I've been thinking a lot about cannibalism, too, about Michael Valentine Smith in Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, about Good Man Friday from Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, and I must say that I find the practice far more respectful of life than the practices of industrial civilization that are so very respectful of ego at the expense of life. What would sovereignty in dying look like? I dream of suicide spas like the one where Saul went in Soylent Green, like the Dignitas rooming house in Switzerland, where a person can have the death they want for whatever reason, or for no reason at all. Homo sapiens is not an endangered species. Remember what I said about things I wouldn't want to live to remember? I wonder if unwillingness to live with their memories is what drives so many military veterans to suicide. Who are we, or doctors, or legislators, or judges and attorneys, or least of all insurance companies, to make that call? Here's a random sampling of my research on suicide from around the world and throughout time. Suicide is mentioned in the Abrahamic Bible in the first book of Kings, chapter 16, verse 18, as an honorable response to military defeat. And in modern times, the U.S. military is said to have provided soldiers with suicide pills in case they would give away secrets if captured and tortured. There is also mention in the Christian Bible of suicide as an expression of extreme remorse in Matthew chapter 27, verse 5. Of particular interest to my demographic is the escalation of sinicide, or elder suicide. The trend has escalated with the aging of the baby boomer generation and the continuing fragmentation of social safety nets at the family, community, and societal level. This trend is often associated with a decline in economic status, social connectedness, health, fitness, and other quality of life issues. Suicide for the common good is called agathousia and might include some incidents of senicide. Euthanasia of the sick and elderly was practiced among the Germanic people of the 5th through 9th century. In India, a peaceful death was traditionally facilitated with oil baths and hydration with coconut water to induce renal failure. Suicide for honor has a long tradition in Japan, seppuku, and euthanasia of elders by abandonment in remote natural settings is also practiced there. The Inuit are said to practice senicide. In times of famine, the elder simply walks away from the settlement and perishes peacefully from hypothermia after 2 or 3 days. Canada legalized euthanasia last summer, and Colombia guaranteed the right to die for terminally ill patients in 2014. The Netherlands legalized voluntary euthanasia in 2001 for cases of hopeless and unbearable suffering, whether physical or mental. And a so far unsuccessful ballot initiative would dispense a lethal dose to everyone at age 70. Paradoxically, the availability of the suicide option is reported to increase longevity and improve the quality of life. I'd also like to consider the wise example of the non-human animals who choose to end their life for social reasons, such as the death of a life partner or the loss of capacity, through illness or injury, to maintain one's status as a contributing community member. While humans seem to be the only ones who employ weapons or other tools to end their lives, incidents have been reported of animals who mate for life using VSED or even drowning themselves in response to the death of a mate. Likewise, there are numerous examples of pets who die not long after their masters. The UK's Daily Mail from 28 August 2009 reports that 28 cows and bulls plunged to their deaths on the rocks below a cliff near a small village in the Swiss Alps in just 3 days. The 19 March 2010 issue of Time carried a story about Kathy, the dolphin star of the TV series Flipper, ending her life deliberately. And Benjamin the Donkey has a report from the non-human world to share as well. Benji?
You know, one of the great stories of Doomer lore is about the St. Matthew deer. 29 reindeer were introduced to the small island of St. Matthew. With no predators and plenty of food at first, the reindeer population rose to about 6,000 before they ran out of food. Within 2 years, the population crashed to 42, and eventually all died out. The Tale of the St. Matthew Deer. Listen, my children, and hear how their island became their bier. Take a seat, lend an ear, you might shed a tear at the tale of the St. Matthew deer. Overshoot, when it came near, made their privation severe. Through conditions austere, it made disappear the whole herd of St. Matthew deer. Doubter, hold back your sneer, 'cause we're right at that same frontier. It's all very clear, there goes our career, the way of the St. Matthew deer. Hee-haw!
Yes, I recall learning about that specific example in school when I took ecology. WeAreSonar.org posted a very interesting blog in January 2016 that explores the possibility that the increasingly frequent beaching of cetaceans or marine mammals may be a conscious response on their part to anthropogenic habitat loss or infection brought about by climate change. In the case of dolphins, no weapon is needed since breathing is a voluntary function for them, not an autonomic one as it is for us. Although the authors have some misguided ideas about the legality of human suicide, their conclusions are worth quoting at length. Quote, "It's safe to say that much of our aversion to death is grounded in a fear of the unknown. This is why we sometimes irrationally hold on to our own lives and those of our loved ones, when it would be more humane to let go. Facing death as an inevitability, something that is every bit as natural and normal as being born, is not something our modern cultures tend to emphasize. This might be where our species again differs from the cetaceans. Could it be that they have an entirely different view of death, and thus of life, than we? Might they view death not as something to be afraid of, but as something to do, together, with their loved ones? Are they not so attached to their individuality, and therefore not so terrified of losing it?" Unquote. In short, death is not a pathology. Death is necessary to life, just as extinction is necessary to evolution. But those who remain must adapt to the loss, whether the loss of a food source at the species level or the loss of a loved one at the individual level. Some of us enjoy using art, particularly music and poetry, as comfort in times of loss. We heard one of David Walensky's poems 6 months ago, and I'm delighted to present another one today, but this time read by the poet himself.
I want to talk a little bit first about your book and give you a chance to promote that.
That book is called The Crane is Flying and is published by Dos Madres Press, which is a small, beautiful, and obscure publisher of poems. It's a guy and his wife, and they work very hard and they do a good job. My book contains only poems that I wrote before 1995.
Uh-huh.
In the first half of that book is a whole sequence, one of the better poems I ever wrote, which was "In California, woke up one morning in a hostel having dreamt that my sister had died." When she died a year later, my sister died in 1970 at the age of 19. So there's that poem, The Anguish of Air. Around that poem in the book are many of the other poems that are the immediate ones about my sister's death and the way in which it has reverberated in myself. Really, the first part is called Anguish of Air for that reason. But as soon as you get to Drawing of the Trees, you're in the Susan poems, and they go right to the end of part one.
So those were all written many years ago, and then you come back last month, and Ghost Story is kind of like a PS or a coda or something.
Yeah, there are probably 10 poems written in the 2000s, or maybe 20. There is a poem in the book which is called The Dead, for Allegra Cohen Almalek, who was my Sephardic grandmother, and all the others. And that's sort of the culmination of the Susan poems from those days, which made it into that book.
The Sister Susan poems. I want to make it clear to the listener that there's several Susans in your life, right?
Yes. They occur with troubling coincidental frequency.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at pianina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in Peace and Nonviolence in Action.
I would love to hear more about Ghost Story and other associated or related poetry from your book.
Okay. Ghost Story was written or drafted last month. This poem is a little bit more abstract and a little bit more always and forever and whoever you are, addressed to whoever you are. So it's not quite as specific as some of the other ones, but it is very clearly one of the other ones.
Would you read your poem, Ghost Story, for us?
I will be happy to read it. Ghost Story. She is smiling in the picture, always and forever. Whoever she was, you know her, whoever you are. The story was old when you were young. Now it is older. Somewhere it reads haunted, somewhere hunted, and somehow ghost has been rhymed with lost. No matter, she will smile. You will not weep now looking at her. You put the album down and go to sleep and dream she is smiling in a picture where your eyes wander forever.
Thank you. Tell our listeners how they can get a hold of your book. Say the title again and how to get a copy.
The name of the book is The Crane is Flying. It is one of the poems in the book. The whole book is less than 50 pages long. It looks very nice, though, because Dos Madres Press does a very good job physically. Robert Murphy does the editing. Elizabeth Murphy does all the art and physical layout stuff, and she's great. So if you want to buy the book, the best thing to do is to buy it from them because they're doing it for love, not money. But it helps when once in a while people actually buy books.
And it's called Dos Madres?
Dos Madres, D-O-S-M-A-D-R-E-S, two mothers. It was named after his mother and her mother, and they gave it the Spanish name. Just look for Dos Madres Press. If you look at that and you stick in Walensky, which is me, you'll get my book. They do not publish any excerpts from the book, which I think all publishers should do. You can see the beautiful cover, though.
It is a beautiful cover. Thanks very much for agreeing to meet with me here today for the sake of artistic embellishment for the Sequitur podcast. I really do appreciate it.
I love closing the show with Elizabeth West and her Sunset Windows. Elizabeth was my featured guest on the show of that title, and also on an earlier one titled Earthbound. I'm happy to feature her short segments whenever there's space, and today I'm additionally feeling a need to shift the focus from death to life. Elizabeth?
Hey, Susan. I have another sunset window that I call the Sense of Joy, and its goal is actually very similar to the one we discussed last time, which was bridging this world with the ones that we inhabit at our highest levels. This one is kinesthetic, and it's simple. I think it's really so pleasant. It's just a delight. And again, should only take 4 or 5 minutes a day. So we are asked, I believe, to act as a bridge between highest consciousness that we have access to and form, which is much denser. And our bodies are the very stuff of which that bridge really asks to be built. It's the link, the connector between what we conceive of as above and below. Miraculous. The body is just an amazing creation itself, and it's one which holds endless mysteries and surprises, as most of us know. One of its capacities, which we want to invite you to delve into this week, is to bring you into joy through the gift of the senses, which are very much part of our body. This amounts very simply to spending about 3 minutes every day, or on the days you choose, in focused absorption of a sensual pleasure offered by the natural world that you tend not to give yourself enough of. So for instance, you might spend 3 minutes sitting with and inhaling a rose, or listening to the birds as they sing their morning song, or trailing your hand in a cool stream, consciously feeling the sun on your skin, watching the sun go down. Do something different every day, or feel free to repeat a practice that really sated you. The point is to allow your body and your soul to be deeply nurtured and fed by taking the time to receive with awareness a gift from this earth through the avenue of one of your senses. We use our vision predominantly to navigate the world. And while it is a sense you can use with this practice, my recommendation is to try to engage one of the other four senses when you can. So here's how it goes. You sit with a rose or a fall of honeysuckle or a lilac, and you bury your nose in it and allow the scent to just fill you up. Allow yourself to feel blessed by such beauty and stay there as long as you like, just taking it in. Or you can find some other joy offered by nature and accessed through one sense primarily, and give yourself over to it altogether for at least 3 minutes. Could be the wind or the sun. It could be the sound of leaves moving in the breeze or the hum of insects. Use whatever is available to you. So often we want to stop and really feel, taste, smell, devour, listen, gaze. But what we do is we end up settling for a passing whiff, a quick glance. And with this practice, you're being encouraged to just indulge yourself. If you need something for your mind to do during this relatively sustained period of attention to another sense, try to notice the layers, the subtleties of scent or sound, the color, the flavor, the timbre. But basically, the idea is to just take in what your sense is communicating to you from the natural world around you. Do your best not to analyze or categorize, just enjoy it. Notice maybe if you want how your body feels, how your heart feels. Notice how it feels to actually live on this planet. And then you can make an intention to carry that feeling forward through your day. You can give yourself permission to touch back into that place again and again. And if you want to, if it helps you, you can make a note of what you experienced, but it isn't necessary. Since this practice does not always lend itself to being done first thing in the morning, you might want to create a reminder for yourself to actually do it during the course of the day. You know yourself and what works best for you. However, at the end of each day before you sleep, if you take a moment or two to revisit your experience and to notice how it changed the day for you, that may be useful. And then give thanks to the world of form, which offers up such wonders, and to your body, which was created to receive them. Everyone is going to have their own unique experience with this practice, I'm sure, but I found for myself a sense of belonging, which is beyond anything I expected. I thought I was going to feel pleasure and joy and delight, but I felt like I belonged in this world in a way that I have never experienced before. I have marveled on different days at the peppery bite of a nasturtium blossom, at the power and intensity, the waves of flavor, then at the vibrant orange of the bloom itself, sinking into that color more and more deeply with each breath, at the velvet touch of its petals on my lips. There was so much there in this one little blossom, this common flower, which, you know, that does make me smile. I like them when I see them going in and out of my front door. But to be able to dive into it, to fall into it, to explore so much more of what it held was really extraordinary. And knowing it in and through my own body, I felt such gratitude. There was an incredible kind of joy that I felt to commune with it in all these different ways, using my senses. On another occasion, I was listening intently to the birds one morning when I woke up. I was just lying in bed and hearing them outside my window. And I decided that was what I was going to focus on. And I felt such a blessing of belonging. It took me totally by surprise. Similarly, lying on my belly in the grass one morning, I was just breathing in the scent of the earth and feeling the tickle of the grass on my face, the warmth of the sun. And I was overcome with this feeling of rightness. I'm part of this. I am meant to be here. I belong here. And honestly, that's something I've struggled with my whole life. So it was pretty impressive for me, pretty much of a revelation. I also noticed that I forget these moments quite easily. And yet I am finding that the more that I do this practice, the more automatically it happens to me. I may be forgetting to intentionally sit and listen to the birds, but when I hear them, suddenly I'm pulled into this place where I'm really focused and allowing the birds to speak to me, to really indulge myself in the beauty of the sound. The flowers remind me when I walk by, and suddenly I'm back in that place again of connectedness and of delight. So for some reason, this practice has given me a really profound sense of home. I have been working with it for a long time now, and I just really love this one. It's one of my favorites.
The sense of joy.
I mean, really, this one feels to me like just pure pleasure, Susan. It has to do with, you know, all those things we put off.
I love the way you came out of it with a sense of belonging. Belonging is one of the universal human needs that we talk about in nonviolent communication.
Mm-hmm.
Which for me in the past several years has been a constant refrain for me. I don't belong here. There's no room for me here. And finding a place to belong right here at my doorstep.
Yeah.
What a gift.
Exactly.
Wow. I was also fascinated that you tended to gravitate towards the sense of smell,
mm-hmm.
which is, evolutionarily speaking, our most primitive sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's processed deep in the brainstem in what they call the reptilian brain, which is one of those things that our more judgmental cognitive centers have called bad.
Right.
So I think when I try it, I'm going to be looking for a smell also, because alienation from the world goes back pre-linguistically to early childhood.
That's fascinating.
So my alienation from the world seems to go back to the pre-linguistic stage of my life. And one of the things that emerged from my dance with death was multiple chemical hypersensitivity.
Right.
I get deeply triggered by smells.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of flooding myself sensorially with a smell that brings delight or pleasure or a sense of belonging
mm-hmm.
might be just the counterbalance that's needed for that particular disorder.
Well, I hope that overall you'll enjoy this one. It is about indulging in what is pleasurable.
I'm thinking of my essential oil collection. I do have some lavender oil,
mm-hmm.
Orange blossom essence.
Orange
blossoms was really sweet. And I do have some Florida water that I made myself, which might be just the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I also mm-hmm. have from that experiment, one of the ingredients was rosemary tincture. And I dearly love the smell of rosemary.
And so experiment with that and just see, because what we tend to do, Susan, is take a whiff, right? Just as we tend to look at the sunset and go, how beautiful. Or, you know, we walk out and we see the full moon and we say, amazing. And then we move on. What this is an invitation to do is to really allow yourself to immerse for just a couple minutes. But it feels like a long time because we don't usually give ourselves that much time.
The word immersion came up as you were describing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yes.
Well, thank you for that.
You're very welcome. And as always, I look forward to hearing anything that you observe while you play with the sense of joy.
Will do. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before I sign off, I have a shout out for culture jamming by the Adbusters during this season of conspicuous consumption. Due to some offline challenges in my personal life, Sequitur missed the opportunity to promote the observance of Gratitude Day on Thursday, Buy Nothing Day on Friday, and Small Business Saturday. But there is still plenty of opportunity to refuse to purchase packaging, keep your money in your community by patronizing locally owned businesses, and give more handmade and symbolic gifts rather than resource-intensive manufactured crap, the purchase of which is nourishment for our metastatic economy. And if you want to be more proactive, here are some simple and fun nonviolent direct actions for the holiday shopping season, courtesy of Adbusters. Credit card cut-up. Stand in the mall with a pair of scissors and a sign, offering passers-by a quick, simple, money-saving service. We'll spare you from extortionist interest rates and mounting debt with one considerate cut. Zombie walk. Follow the logic of capitalist consumption to its inevitable cannibalistic conclusion. Dress in dark and dirty rags and tatters, be creative with makeup, and wander the mall as the walking dead. Jesus walk. Improvise a robe or toga, embellish a headband with a cardboard halo, and walk ever so slowly through the throngs of impatient holiday shoppers in meditative silence, giving the universal sign of benediction whenever you are confronted. Whirly mart. Gather your tribe and create a long, silent, inexplicable conga line of shopping carts at the big box store without actually buying anything. That's it for now. Thanks to Darcy Myers and Adam Sekuler for Tomorrow Never Knows, which promises to be a moving and meaningful documentary. To Elizabeth West for her Sunset Windows practices. To David Walensky for Ghost Story. To the Adbusters for their tireless work on behalf of We the People. To Dusty Springfield for her beautiful rendition of Carole King's song Goin' Back. To Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary. And to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. Thank you.